So I'm going to say something that's controversial.
Please.
But it's my opinion.
Yes.
There are too many restaurants.
Yeah.
What story are you telling?
Right.
What are you offering the community?
And then food is medicine. The other vulnerable thing is potentially illness or healing, which is really complicated and fraught for a lot of people. And maybe they've been told they can't heal, or maybe they've been told they're broken, or they've taken on board that this is who they are.
But if you want something weird, I can make that up for you. Truly. Like, I could do it.
Like, food is a very intimate relationship. Welcome back to the Marian Flaxman Network Podcast, a podcast dedicated to reintroducing personal narratives into critical public health topics. On today's episode, my conversation with Chef Kendra Nicole Stevens. After getting a degree in psychology, Kendra took a job in a bake shop while deciding what to do next. On some level, she never left. After falling in love with the creative side of cooking, she became a lifelong student of the craft, rising to powerful culinary positions, yet always remaining curious. These days, she's the Director of Culinary Operations and Innovation at Christ House, a respite for unhoused men in Washington, D.C. She's passionate about fresh, local, seasonal food and the power of food as medicine. And in this conversation, we discuss some critical topics, such as the important role of chefs in the food as medicine landscape. Please enjoy my conversation with Kendra Nicole Stevens. Kendra, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It is a joy to have you. So I want to start where I love to start, because okay. I'm always curious when I know someone with a cool and unique career. What did you think you wanted to be when you grew up, like when you were a kid?
So I think I was obsessed with movies, and I'm still obsessed with, like, I knew jingles and movies and things like that. So I think probably an actress.
Oh, I love
it's
that.
Really weird. But yeah, an actress. So I still to this day know every commercial from, like, back in the day. I can tell you TV theme song. So probably like a jingle writer or some actress. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But probably that's what I was thinking that I would be.
Well, I love you saying that, because often when I'm in the kitchen, mm-hmm. and like, spoiler alert, she works in kitchens now, actually, not an actress or jingle writer. But I often will think to myself, like, this is a ballet, like that has to go in, and then I turn around and then that goes in, and then I spin this way and that goes in. And I love that part of it.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, like, do you ever feel that when you're in the kitchen that you're like on stage and it's a production?
Absolutely. Especially because of where I work now. So there's this like big window. Have you been to the Christ House?
Yeah.
So you know that there's this like gate that opens.
Right.
And so the guys are kind of just sitting there just trying to figure out what you're doing. And I think this Christmas I was making croquembouche. And so I'm building it and they're all looking. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm being funny, but
totally.
It's, yeah, definitely is a show. And then when things are in sync, it feels like a symphony, you
yes.
know, like if you have the right cook with you, or just everything is happening the way it's supposed to and comes out beautifully, your sauce, everything, it does feel like a concert of sorts. So
yes,
I do agree with that.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, so take me on the journey then from little Kendra, who's getting into the jingles and thinking about the stage. How did you walk that path from that into the culinary arts?
So as a kid, I was obsessed with cookies. And there was like a cookie that was soft, like a soft batch cookie. Mm. And I didn't understand like how it was soft. So I spent like a summer just buying, asking my parents for the cookies so I could test them and figure out how to recreate them. So that's how the cookie started.
I need to know more about this cookie. So it was like a store-bought cookie or a bakery?
It was a store-bought cookie.
Okay, and it was like chewy,
it was
soft.
Chewy, soft. Because if you think about like what most cookies, like, I don't know, like a...
Chips Ahoy.
It was like crunchy. But this was a soft batch, yeah. like chocolate chip cookie, the first time I ever tried it. And I did not understand why it was soft, but I really liked the texture of it.
Yeah.
And I tried to recreate this thing. And then from there, it was, hey, does anybody have a recipe for a cookie? And so then as a kid, like in sixth and seventh grade, I was making cookies for everybody. So all the Christmases for like gifts, people got cookies. And I was a little... I drank early as a kid.
Okay.
But anyway, we would have these cookie and Kahlua parties.
Oh my gosh.
What we thought we were like adults. So
yes.
Like at 16, you would have like
that's
cookies
awesome.
And Kahlua. And then was also obsessed with, like, the grocery store uh-huh. as a child. Like, it was one of the things that I really liked. And in Cleveland, there is, like, a Shaker Square Market or a market, and then there's a West Side Market, and then the Ohio, the Miles Market. And it was, like, all these stalls and just, like, stuff and, like, nuts and just things that you can consume. But they were beautiful to me. It was really intriguing. Like, how can I make this, or what can I do with all this stuff? So I think I've always liked food, and my mother was not a good cook. And if she's listening to this, I'm sorry, Mommy. She just didn't cook.
Yeah.
So I think I was just interested because she just didn't really know how to cook.
Right.
She cooked certain things. Like, she'd make a lasagna that always had too much cheese. But she didn't really make, like, the meals. Like, she would say, I made some chicken and there are some chips. So, like, I think fourth grade probably was the earliest. Like, I started to say, can I have some recipes? Like, I would find recipes in the newspaper or go to the library, which was also my favorite. It's also, to this day, yeah. my favorite place to go. Go to the library, get cookbooks, and just recreate stuff. So I did that very early. And then when I got to Howard and then I graduated with a degree in psychology and didn't know what to do with that, I was like, let me take a year off and figure out if I'm going to go to med school for psychology or psychiatry or if I'm going to do something else. And I got a part-time job in a bake shop here in D.C. And that was it. I was like, I like this.
Yeah.
This is good. Yeah.
So it all started with cookies.
It started with cookies.
And a curiosity. I mean, like, what mm-hmm. I'm hearing in that story is that you were insatiably curious.
Curious.
You needed to know, how is this happening? Like, what makes this cookie different?
Yes. And I think I learn by just, like, trial and error. Like, mm-hmm. I want to see. Like, you tell me something, and I'm like, okay, but how does it work? So I need to know the ins and out of it. Like, how does this really work? Like, I need to put my hands on it to make sure that it's right. So
yeah.
That's how it started.
Yeah. Well, I can totally relate to that. As I told you earlier off the mic, my favorite thing is, like, let me get into the kitchen and just, like, mess with things and
yeah.
figure out, like, okay, if I have this ingredient and I'm looking at this recipe and I don't have that ingredient, how can I use these weird things that I do have
yeah.
to make it? Like, I find that very, very fun. Like, if there was a version of Chopped, you know that show Chopped?
I know Chopped.
If there was a version of Chopped that was, like, all farm to table and, like, gluten free, and they, like, open the basket and it's, like, seasonal local fresh produce, and it's, like, figure out how to make this happen. That's, like, my dream experience is, like, local organic food as medicine Chopped. Maybe we should do that.
I think that what could happen with this show is that, or what should happen with this show is that we would pair this, your version of local organic, and then we'd have another team that does the traditional thing. And in the end, the judges who are whatever could decide, like, oh, my God, this tastes even better, or this doesn't work. And so, yes, that is a show.
Yeah.
That is definitely a show.
Okay. Well, we can merge our shared interest in health and being on camera and
Correct.
Stage. And you can write the jingle, and it can all be full circle.
I think that I don't need to write the jingle. There's somebody back
okay,
there
you're
who
right.
should write the
we
jingle.
We have someone on staff
yes,
here that
you
can
do.
Write the jingle.
I think it
We're
was going to be
–
because your music is awesome. So, yes.
We're ready for this show. Okay.
Exactly.
Well, putting that future hit show to the side for
okay.
just a second – I want to know a bit more about your culinary journey. So you have this degree in psychology, you're working in a bake shop, yada, yada, yada. You end up doing pastry at the Kennedy Center. And that is, like, a huge – I happen to know people who put on events there. It's a lot of people at those events. We're not talking about 24 cupcakes.
It's
we're talking a
yeah,
lot. So
it's not.
Talk to me about, like, how you got to that point where you are experienced, you're confident, and you're putting out huge amounts of elegant pastry.
So after I left the pastry shop, I decided I didn't have enough experience, so I needed to get some training. So I moved to New York, and I was preparing to go to Paris to go to school at the Ritz. So when I came back from the Ritz, I started Claudette's Cookies, which was my catering company, and I had, like, all these clients. I'm, like, 21 years old, and I have all these clients, and I'm making cookies and little petite pastries for people. But it was expensive, and I was getting killed with, like, the taxes was problematic. So I had a friend who worked as a contractor at the Kennedy Center just for the galas. Mm-hmm. Like, so they're like, hey, do you want to do it? And I was like, sure. So I started just part-time working, and I became friends with the chef. And he knew that I did, like, pastries. So he's like, hey, do you want a job? And I was like, absolutely not. I'm free. I don't need to work for anyone. But he kept asking me. And I think it was during, like, what, 2012. The recession was sort of, like, from 2008 was still, like, trickling.
Totally.
And so he's like, listen, figure out what you need and if you can do it and what's important for you. And I said, freedom. And the freedom to choose and create things, because that's what I do right now for myself. And he said, okay, so on our dime, you can create for us and treat it like a small business. And so I started, and I was only supposed to be there for a year, but I stayed until COVID. So I stayed for seven and a half years.
That's amazing.
And it was, you know, there are things I didn't know, but I needed to push myself. So there were classes that I was allowed to take. So they let me take classes at ICE in New York. And I did that like once a month. I took classes, and then it was like 7,000, 12,000 pastries with a team of four from scratch without help from anybody else. So we did it. Like for Honors, Honors was our largest event, and that's a 2,500 plated dinner, but there's little free undies, like, you know, so maybe 400 tier stands of like 20 different versions, like 20 different desserts. And we did all of that. So it was for me, like what you said, like, it's just like so exciting, like just being able to order. That's my thing too. Like ordering things and figuring out what, like somebody's coming in from like New Zealand or somewhere like Norway or Sweden. Like, what can I get? So we get sea buckthorn, and you try these things that are just kind of foreign to other people, and you put it together. And a lot of the galas were also themed. So mm-hmm. It was like, what is modern French? So in France, it's Japanese and French. And so you pair these things together and you make these beautiful plated dinners. And so it was really fun for me to do that. So
yeah, it sounds fun.
Yeah, it's fun. It was fun. And I still enjoy doing that. I can't tell you, you'd love a cake I made that's just a plain grandma's cake. But if you want something weird, I can make that up for you. Truly. Like, I could do it. So
that should be like your slogan. Like, if you want something weird, I've got you. And that's like your business card.
Maybe. But I have like 1,000. They used to be called, what is it? Google, the domains. But that's now whatever they are. I have 1,000 companies. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Well, if there's one thing that I know that you and I are both good at, it's dreaming up new business ideas, because we love to do it together as well, which is going to bring me to how we met.
Yes.
Of course, which is Dr. Kofi introduced us, because you were reaching out, looking for someone to talk to about food as medicine, using food in a different way. So I kind of want to chat about that. Like, where did that seed come from in your mind? What got you curious? Because obviously pastry is fun, but it's not known for its medicinal qualities generally, except maybe comforting, psychologically medicinal. But what took you from, okay, I'm a badass pastry chef, I'm making thousands of tiny cakes, to like, I want to reach out to a local physician and see if we can talk about food as medicine?
So that's the Anacostia Culinary Arts Center. So during COVID, you know, it was just it was very frightening for everyone.
Yeah.
And it was like, what? So yeah, you make 1,000 pastries, thousands of pastries for people, and then that's it. It's over. How do you contribute to society as a whole with what you have, what I've been doing for all my life? Like, how could I contribute in a way that was meaningful? And so I thought about it, and I was like, okay, I should start a culinary arts center. And it basically started, so during COVID, DC government was giving like money left and right, like try this thing and you want to open a small business. And so I did this like business summit with a bunch of other small businesses. And so we had to get together, pair as groups, and just like figure out what our new business plan or theme was going to be. So I came up with this pastry shop. But when we all read it, they were like, girl, this is not a pastry shop. This is a social enterprise, because it was about like giving back to the community and eating healthy foods and making sure people had access to farms and stuff like that. So it was like, that's not it. So then overnight it became the Anacostia Culinary Arts Center. So I like found a building and I had like the LOI on the building and I was looking, getting grants and all these things were happening. And so what I really wanted to make sure is that it was like congruent, like everything that happened in that building, the food access, all of that stuff, like there was access to health and medicine, that it really resonated with the community, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was trying to find a dietitian, trying to find people that could help me get some answers to like, what is this food as medicine thing? Because it was happening at that point. And I couldn't find anybody to talk to about it. So I just went to LinkedIn and was like, okay, this dude right here says this food is medicine. So I reached out to him and he actually wrote me back.
Yeah.
So we met and then he said, I know this wonderful woman. Her name is Marianne Flaxman and she's going to talk to you. And it's going to be amazing. And I said, okay. And you did. And so that's how it started.
It's true. Yeah. Shout out to Kofi. It's always like he's the best example of if you want something done, ask the busiest person you know. Because there's no one who's more in demand than him. He's like, if you look him up, he's like the keynote speaker here and the panelist here and the head of this here. And he's traveling there and he has kids at home and he's doing it all. And he will respond to your email. Like, he will. He's really oddly good at that. So
I think that is, yeah, I was so surprised because he gave me a whole hour and then said, you can follow up with me and let me know what you're doing and how you're doing. And then we did, like, the three or four or five of us from Christ House and you with him. I just think it's amazing that he offers himself that way. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think the world of food as medicine, which is growing and changing and having an interesting moment right now, I think it inspires and it attracts passionate people. Okay. And when you have that personal passion, it's easier to lean in and put that extra time in because, you know, like for myself, like someone says food is medicine or microbiome, gut health, and I'm like, how can I help? Hi, hello.
Yes, you are good that way as well.
So it's like when you're that passionate about something, I think like showing up a little bit extra above and beyond, it feels like just what you want to do. So you reached out to him, you had this thought, it's rooted in the Culinary Arts Center, you're picturing, well, tell me a little bit more about that place because I want to see it in your mind. It doesn't physically exist right now, but talk me through.
Oh my
like,
God! It was
the
Marianne,
dream.
It was the dream was that there is a building, right? And in this building, there's rooftop guard, like there's hydroponics inside, and then on the rooftop, there's access to gardens, and so restaurants because we struggled during COVID, like restaurants closed because we had to rely on the chef's warehouse, the Baldors, and we did not have an infrastructure that supported local. Organic or just local produce and things like that. So everything is available in this building. There are restaurant concepts. There is teaching kitchens. There is anything for a small business. There is a program that like you have a startup, like this space is for you, for your startup for 6 or 8 months. And then there's financing. And so there was a whole thing and restaurant concepts and all this stuff. Composting, everything that you need was in this building. But most importantly, it was for the community. Like there would be rotisseries where you'd have like, you can come in like you go to Costco, but I would be connected to a farmer and the farmer would just like park right there. They could have like a little farmer's market. They could sell the chicken. We could roast the chicken. And everyone had a meal that was affordable. So that was the idea of the place. And so everyone loved it in Ward 8 and they thought that it was great, but the money dried up.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to go off script and ask a question.
Yeah.
Because as I'm picturing that, I'm picturing recently there's been this trend of the food hall.
Yeah.
And they're all closing.
Yeah.
I mean, food hall after food hall, not all of them. There's the old, you know, Union Market is still, I think, doing great. But I saw a recent article was saying that the most successful food hall is this one, I think it's called Wonder. And it's like successful because it's like
in DC or where?
I think there's one in DC and there's one maybe opening somewhere in Maryland. But the idea was like it was more successful because it was more automated, didn't need as much staff. And that makes me sad. Like what I'm picturing with what you're describing is almost like, what if the food halls went in the opposite direction and they said, we're not just going to be these different stalls where you can come with your friends and everyone gets what they want, but also there's a central composting area. And also there are cooking classes 5 times a week. And also there's a farmer that comes. Like, mm-hmm. what if instead of trying to go as low touch as possible, they went the other way and tried to go higher touch and lean into being a hub for the community? Like, could we save the food hall by making it higher touch as opposed to lower touch?
So I think so. There's a food hall down the street from you that closed.
Exactly. I know.
Yeah.
Rest in peace to the Heights.
But
I loved it for a second.
You did?
Yeah. Well, because they had DC Dosa, which okay. I was just thrilled to not have to drive all the way to Union Market for okay. that. Because okay. it's kind of a trek from here. And I love a good dosa. And there it was, 5 minutes from my house. But who am I? I'm a working mom. I'm a cook. Like, I cook, so I went there like 4 times a year. I'm not keeping it afloat with my 4 times a year patronage, you know?
So I'm going to say something that's controversial.
Please.
But it's my opinion.
Yes.
There are too many restaurants.
Yeah.
I think that there are too many restaurants. There are too many okay restaurants. And mm-hmm. so post-COVID, people have to decide where they're going to spend their money.
Yes.
So if you don't have that thing, and like even today, like if I go out and I'm going to go hang out someplace, there are places that are always busy that are really, really expensive. Mm-hmm. And there are places that are not as expensive, but never busy.
Right.
And it's because, but you think, what are they offering?
Right.
And I think that it's sometimes like, what is the culture? Like, what story are you telling?
Right.
What are you offering the community? And I think those things are important. So I don't know about food halls. I know like in Lisbon, the Mercados are so like they're bustling.
Right.
But those are also like very heavy areas of for tourists. So I think that when you have so much, people have choices. And
yeah.
I think, unfortunately, people are just don't choose those things, maybe.
I don't find that opinion controversial at all, but maybe that's only because it's my exact opinion.
Okay.
I very recently was talking to another mom about takeout mm-hmm. and about going out to eat. And we were saying, okay, I'm already paying more at the grocery store. So let's say for a meal, grocery store plus my effort, $30.
Yeah.
Mid-tier restaurant, $75 now. And then a high-end restaurant, $150. But at home, I have the comfort of home. I have it exactly as I want it. I have my TV and my kids and my cozy, and it's comfortable. At the high-end place, I've got care and detail and crisp linen, and I'm transported from my daily life. And at the mid-level restaurant, where I'm paying more than twice what I would pay at home, I'm looking around because where's my server? She's texting in the corner and the food comes out and it obviously was held hot for too long. So I'm pushing it back and then I'm getting attitude. And then do I tip 20 or 25? Because even though it was subpar service, 15 feels cheap these days and you really got to give at least 20 or you're a bad person. And suddenly I'm not having a good time.
Correct.
Why am I paying $75 to eat worse food and have a worse experience than home? But I would pay $150 to be cared for.
And that's the truth.
And
that's...
so, yes, a lot of restaurants rushed to fill this like Applebee's middle ground, mm-hmm. but now it's like an elevated Applebee's. Like it's basically Applebee's business model, but like we use organic ingredients. Do they? It's still the Cisco truck pulling up, right? It's not farm to table. So like, why are we paying $75 for the Applebee's experience? Like,
I agree with you. And that is my rule as a chef. So when I get invited by all my friends who say they're the F word, the bad F word for chefs mm-hmm. is foodie. Mm-hmm. I can't stand it. Yeah. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
But I always say to them, no, I'm not spending money to just eat at some place that I could, you know, I could cook this in this kitchen right here. I'm mm-hmm. not doing it, but I will go for an experience. I will go for a great cocktail mm-hmm. and sit back in my chair, lean back in my chair and say, oh my God, can you believe that dessert was so good? And like, this was so delicious.
Yeah.
I will go for that experience. And sometimes it's $200. It's not often. I don't do that every week or month, but I agree with you. I do that before I would just walk into some place and have a mediocre meal.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem is that there's so many people just starving to open something. And I have a client now who owns a koshery business. He is Egyptian. And so my question to him is like, when we talk about like, what are you going to do? Like, where are you going to get your herbs? And he's like, and I said, you know, he's like, I don't know where to get the herbs. I'm like, you get the herbs from Egypt. Who is the person who has the market, the famous market, the market that you know this guy, and you're going to get the best herbs? And I said, do you know that person? He's like, yeah. And he said, I know that person well. It's like a family friend. I was like, okay, well, then you have that guy ship you this stuff. And then your business model is about like this. This is what you're doing. It can't just be I'm getting some stuff from Sysco.
Right.
And I'm going to make a meal.
Right.
From this stuff. It has to tell a story. Everything you do has to tell a story. And I think that's what's missing. It's like we're just giving a $17 burger to someone and you want them to come in and pay you for this burger that is just something that just tastes okay.
Right.
So.
Yeah. No, I feel the exact same way. I think people ask me a lot about like what recipes I cook from at home. And I'm like, oh, no. No, when I'm at home, I'm like a simple roasted chicken thigh with a half cup of brown rice. You know, the other day I cooked my brown rice in vegetable broth as opposed to just water. And I was like, ooh, you know, I'm like really treating myself. But for me at home, it's like simple, 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 simple. That's what I like. If I'm going somewhere and paying a lot, it's fun to have it be, you know, a pomegranate jus or whatever the heck they're doing. But like, I'm not doing that for my pleasure.
Correct.
Like that is an art form that I appreciate, but it's not day-to-day eating. And this idea, like when I was a kid, we did not go out to eat.
Right.
We had like a pizza once in a while. There was like a Chinese takeout maybe every couple months or so. But it wasn't like dining out was a common activity. And these days, there's like this like middle ground restaurant that expects you to go there for dinner on a Tuesday night.
But that's what people were doing, Marianne, before COVID. People were just spending all of their money at restaurants. And like you have a demographic, like you have this, I don't know, are they millennials? Like that they will live in a neighborhood with all the restaurants and they go there every night. But I think when we talk about like what's healthy, that is where you find the stuff that is not so good for you.
Right.
I believe those higher end restaurants, some of them, not all of them.
Right.
And we talked about this before we kind of started. They have more of a food is medicine philosophy than I think some of the, you know,
totally
fast casuals have.
Because they're doing more actual farm to table.
They're doing more farm to table.
And real scratch cooking. They're making their own sauces. They're making their own dressings.
Yeah.
It's not like fast scratch where they're getting like a tub of barbecue sauce and like making it work. They're like actually making things from ingredient, which at the end of the day is always going to be healthier than getting the things in the jugs and the bags and, and all that stuff, which is coming off the – sorry, Sysco, to be taking so much heat in this conversation, but like the
Sysco
truck. What
do you know about Sysco? Oh, I guess you know about
Sysco. I've done a lot of business with Sysco. I've seen many a Sysco truck pulling up to my restaurant.
So you don't use
Sysco. Running.
I won't use Sysco.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I apologize to Sysco.
Sorry, Sysco.
I'm not coming for them particularly, but they are kind of a bad word in the scratch cooking farm to table. You know,
it's not just Sysco.
You don't want to need Sysco.
U.S. food is the same.
Right.
Yeah, U.S. foods.
Right. Exactly.
Not so good.
So, okay. The funny thing about the two of us is that we really could just go really long and deep on any of these sort of side topics. But I wanna pull in a little bit. I'm going to rein us back. And I'm going to focus a bit more on what you're currently doing at Christ House. So first of all, I know what Christ House is. But why don't you tell other people what Christ House is? And then let's talk about your role there and maybe how it's evolved.
So I volunteered at Christ House, which is a respite in the heart of Adams Morgan in Washington, D.C. And so I volunteered there as a college student at Howard. And it's for the chronically homeless. There's 30 beds. And these men eat 3 meals a day, 7 days a week. So we're always feeding them. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. My title is long, but it is I am the Culinary Innovation Operations Specialist. So basically what I do, I started in March of 2025, and I came into the space. There were lots of cans. And so I said, okay, this is what I can offer. I can offer you sort of a farm-to-table experience. So we got rid of the canned goods. I started to build relationships with U.S. Food Rescue, which we are allowed to go every Sunday and to DuPont Farmers Market and like pick up. So we do that, all the vegetables, and then we'll have another side story. So let's think about Carl and this story I'm going to tell you about the vegetables. We pick up, you know, cheese and milk and bread and things like that. And then for fish, it's only hook and line. I will not do farm raise anything. I think we did order a Schooner Bay because I know that hatchery. We use that at the Kennedy Center. So I do know it's a clean concept. We feed them. I have always been like, I understand, like this, as you do, you know how to replace something. Like if this is a fat, what can I replace this fat with? So they don't like brown rice. Like you just said, you make brown rice with vegetable broth. So what I start doing is brown rice, coconut milk, some lime, bay leaves, like just fresh herbs, and just they eat it. Mm-hmm. So it's really about, for me, because you have to think healthy mentally, physically, but what they eat is so important.
Right.
And getting them to understand that food is medicine is less about, okay, you eat this. And I learned that from Carl. And more about, like, what can we give them that's sort of like what they're used to, and then they feel satisfied. So yesterday's meal, I told you, was catfish. I found wild blue catfish, which I do not like catfish. They had wild blue catfish. They had mashed potatoes, olive oil mashed potatoes with confit garlic. And then there was, like, a kale and arugula salad that they ate because I dressed it for winter. That's a term I use, like, dress it light for summer, dress it heavy for winter, because they're not going to eat it unless it's dressed heavy. So they ate it, and they asked for not seconds of the potatoes, but thirds of the potatoes. And they sat in silence, and they ate the meal. And they were like, oh, my God, that was so – the fish was so good, because they enjoyed it. But there are times when I started that I was trying to force myself on them.
Right.
You eat this rapini or, you know, kohlrabi. And I'm like, what the f*** is kohlrabi? I don't want kohlrabi.
Right.
So DC Central Kitchen also is a part of the rescue at DuPont Farmers Market. And they only accept three things. Kale, collard greens, and potatoes. They won't take anything else.
Because they know they can use it and it'll get eaten.
They know that that is what their population will eat.
Right.
And so I have to be to acknowledge that there are some shortcomings. And so when you talk about, like, how can chefs and restaurants be more, you know, teach food as medicine, it's really just, like, thinking about, like, who the person is as a whole. Like, they didn't just arrive and didn't have anything to eat. They've had experiences and they have, you know, they're particular about things that they eat. So I have to be cognizant of the fact that they're just not going to eat what I tell them.
Right.
They want to eat what's good.
Right.
So,
okay, a quick step back. I want to define a few terms and introduce a few characters so everyone can stay with us in this conversation. So first of all, you said Christ House is a respite.
Yes.
For chronically homeless men.
Mm-hmm.
But just to give a little more color to that, this tends to be men who were living on the streets, chronically homeless. They had a health issue.
Yes.
Something either chronic or acute, which makes them less able to make it on the streets or in a shelter.
Correct.
And so they come to Christ's House to get more of a hands-on, not inpatient care, but there are nurses on staff. They do have some inpatient capabilities. They can get medication administered. They can see a doctor. So they are being cared for and able to recuperate.
Correct.
For some length of time.
So it's between. So we get some guys in for a month or two. Some of them are there for longer, like 3 to 6 months that they're there. Maybe not 6 months, but 3 or 4 months I've had guys there. I've been there for 11 months. So, yeah, I would say the longest stay would be about 3 months. So, yes, they're there for care, to recover. Yeah. Sometimes there's cancer. There are all kinds of illnesses. It's diabetes, hypertension, a host of illnesses.
Right. And then Carl is our friend, Chef Carl Guggenmos, who I met through the American Academy of Culinary Medicine. He's also the former dean of Johnson & Wales. Shout out to where my daughter goes to college. So it's all kinds of connections here. But Chef Carl is brilliant. He's been a chef for, I don't know, 50 years. He's from Germany. And he has this sort of wisdom about food, which is It does need to be delicious first. You have to meet the client, the person you're cooking for, where they are. And if you just dictate to someone, you're going to be having food as medicine now. Here is your, you know, like raw greens with like a drizzle of lemon juice on top, and you better like it and say thank you. They're going to throw it away and they're going to find their food somewhere else. And so he said, meet people where they are, make things that are delicious, figure out what they like. And if you can find opportunities to make the sauce from scratch or get the fish wild caught or trim the sodium in a recipe, right?
Like, yes.
You can find your wins where you find them, but you need to meet people where they are. And that's true with like everything, I think. Any behavior change, like if you want to go study the psychology of behavior change, you're always going to be like meeting people where they are. But I do think there's two like vulnerable things happening at once in food as medicine. Thing number one, eating. It's a vulnerable thing. If you think about it from a survival perspective, from a social perspective, like you're taking something on to your personhood. It's entering you. It's becoming you.
Yeah.
Like food is a very intimate relationship. And then food is medicine. The other vulnerable thing is potentially illness or healing, which is really complicated and fraught for a lot of people. And maybe they've been told they can't heal, or maybe they've been told they're broken, or they've taken on board that this is who they are, right? They have diabetes. They are hypertensive. Like this is about them now. It's their personhood. So food is medicine. It's such a scary, intimate space. And to meet someone in that intimate space and to not be willing to meet them where they are and to make them something that they enjoy eating,
yeah,
we've lost them already.
Correct.
So Chef Carl brings that wisdom to the table, which is like, yes, it's all well and good to learn about these healthy foods and all the medicinal properties of them, but ultimately, what is your patient willing to eat today?
Yeah.
Because if they're not willing to eat that, then it's not food as medicine, it's food as trash can.
That is true. And that happens. I mean, I think in going back to what I was telling you about DC Central Kitchen only accepting certain things, I was forcing for a spell these really like beautiful greens on them, you know, Romanesco. Mm-hmm. Like, what is this? Why is this? Is it cauliflower?
Yep.
Is it purple? What is this? You know, like they were not having it. And yeah. It was going, so I started to weigh the food before they could trash it, like weigh the vegetables. They would eat the protein, throw their vegetables in the trash. And so we were weighing it. And I was like, I have to step back from this and figure out what it is they want. I know they like vinegar. I know they like, you know, tangy. I know they like a little bit sweet. And how can I do that and make it healthy? And so I've been working on that. And that's what my goal is, like, you know, figuring out what they like. And we also have surveys. So when they are admitted, they get a survey. It's like, what do you like to eat? Like, what's your favorite vegetables? And there's a list of vegetables on the side. And some men are very specific. They're like, I want this. I want that. So then I know that I can put that on a menu and say, this is Mr. Blah, blah, blah's meal. Like, this is his meal. It's for him. And that was a scandal. You want to hear about the scandal?
Yes, of course.
So we got some sardines from Portugal. Ooh. Because we had two guys that said they like sardines. And if you know anything about DC, there's a famous go-go band called the Junkyard Band, and they have a song called Sardines and Pork and Beans. So I thought it would be so cool if I char-grilled these sardines that were so delicious, that were marinated in olive oil, and they had all this stuff, right? They were delicious. It was a scandal. The nurse's station, my boss, like people walked out. They didn't eat it. They walked out. The two guys who wanted the sardines.
Because the cute little fish scared them?
They just thought it was disgusting that we had sardines, and they thought they were from a can.
Mm.
And they didn't want it. They just didn't want it. Like, some people liked it, but they didn't want to have anything to do with sardines. So
those who liked it loved it.
They loved it. I mean, the nurse's station wrote me, and they were like, hey, like, what is happening down there? We don't know what's going on. But they said, they wrote back and were like, these are delicious. It's delicious. It was so good. But they didn't, it was a house meeting, because what happens is they meet and they talk about like things that they like and things they don't like. They were adamant that that was just the most disgusting thing that they did not taste.
Yeah.
They did not want to have it.
Well, so, you eat with your eyes first.
Yes, true.
And they were scared.
Yeah. I mean, for them, it was just like, no. But so I still have some sardines in the freezer that I have to figure out what to do with. So it is very, sometimes it could be disconcerting because you really want them to be better. You feel like if they just eat those vegetables every day and just like not have a soda, but it's not for me to say.
Right.
You know, it's not.
Yeah. And I have a hard time not totally spiraling out here to like every related topic because, first of all, you're doing this like institutional health focused cooking and it's for like 60
people. We also have permanent housing across the street. So if we have space in the building that we own, then, you know, the guys can go there and they live and they have kitchens and they can cook for themselves. But they also they can eat with us the three meals a day if they want, if they choose. They're in the program. So they're in the program for life.
Right. Okay. So we have like 60 men mm-hmm. who could be showing up to eat. And even with that, that's like a lot of people. And also compared to a hospital, it's quite few, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the challenges of institutional feeding, when you're trying to do it better, trying to elevate the craft, trying to make it cleaner, healthier, fresher, more appealing, mm-hmm. more focused on what the patient feels comforted by, you see how it immediately becomes crazy because it's hard to do it for 60, let alone, you know, 600 or however many people are going to be in a hospital or an old person's home or a prison for that matter, right? Any kind of large setting where you want to feed people better.
Right.
Better is a tricky word. Healthy is a tricky word.
Healthy is a tricky word. That is true.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people think that they're eating a salad and it's healthy and then you tell them, well, it's iceberg lettuce and you have ranch dressing on it.
Right.
And did you read the back of that bottle?
Right.
It has high fructose corn syrup.
500 ingredients.
Yeah. I mean, the day I posted the Chick-fil-A sandwich, the 55 ingredients, people were like, oh, I don't have time for this. This is ridiculous. Why would you put that up there? I'm like, it has 55 ingredients in it. Why do you want to eat that?
Right.
But they don't care. They're like, it's a sandwich. It tastes good. I don't care about the brine. I don't care about that my extremities are going to swell from this. They just want it.
Right. And some of that is comfort. And mm-hmm. some of that, I think, is just information overwhelm. Like, not every person has the time or the mental energy to make figuring out the exact right way to eat their full-time job. It happens that you and I have taken that on as our cross to bear.
Well, but even I was surprised. So I am in this food is medicine cohort with, you know.
Oh, yeah. The culinary medicine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we were doing like an experiment for class where we had to go like to Chipotle, not really, but like just go online and look at this chicken bowl or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea. Like, I think people who go to Chipotle think that they're getting a healthy meal, but the sodium and the carbs and just the calories, it was crazy. Mm-hmm. It was on just like the tomato sauce, like 500-600 calories for, you know, what's in it.
Right.
So I think, you know, people believe that they're eating a certain way going out. They're eating better, but they're not necessarily eating better.
Yeah.
And that's a sad thing.
There's a lot, especially when it comes to things like sodium is a really, mm-hmm. a really easy one. When anything prepared, like my grandpa, who is no longer with us, but when he was still around, he had some kidney issues. Mm-hmm. And so his doctor said, eat a low sodium diet. And he was going to this like salad bar every day, old people's luncheon, you know, whatever, like the early bird special kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they had a soup bar.
Oof.
And he was getting like the vegetable soup. And his dietitian from the kidney doctor was like, let's look up the recipe for that vegetable soup from this restaurant. And it was like 5,000 milligrams of sodium. And like it was crazy. Like it was like 10 times his daily limit for sodium. Mm. He definitely thought, I'm eating healthy, right? Every old person who goes out for soup and salad is not doing it because they're being rebellious, right? Like, if someone's trying to rebel, they're going out for like a cigarette and a Coke or something. Like, they're not going out for soup and salad.
Correct.
Soup and salad is what you do when you're being good.
Yeah.
So to know that you're going out to be good and it's not so good, I think that's a big slap in the face for a lot of people. And it's also very confusing. We live in a world currently, obviously, the new dietary guidelines for America have dropped, and I think I'm going to have to do a whole episode, actually.
You should.
Just on unpacking that. But I do think, like, on some level, the people behind those guidelines feel like, we've made it simpler. Just eat real food. Okay, well, the word eat is complicated, the word real is complicated, and the word food is complicated. Like, for the average person, like, they go to Chick-fil-A, like, that's real. It's a warm chicken sandwich. It's not a bag of chips. It's not candy. Well, no, not that real food. We mean real food. We mean, like, have a wife at home who's cooking your food. Putting that rant to the side. We think that we can make it simple in that way. Eat real food. And I love it. I love telling people to eat real food. They should. But what does that mean?
Exactly.
And if you have no framework, if you're me and you've spent 20 years studying nutrition and agriculture, you probably can take that recommendation on board and operationalize it. In fact, you could have been for the last 20 years and you didn't need that recommendation, right?
Right.
But if you are the kind of person who is turning to the dietary guidelines for dietary advice, which I don't know who that is, actually, but if you are, can you operationalize eat real food? Like, does that hit home in a way that is operationalizable? Like, can you take that with you?
I don't think you can. And I think people are starving for, you know, that's why all these cooking shows are so famous or popular, is because people don't know how to cook.
Right.
They don't know what to eat. I don't know if I told you this, but there's a company called Row 7. Did I tell you about Row 7? Mm-mm. So Row 7 is a seed company. Dan Barber is the owner. And so they needed people to help them sort of grow the business. So I went out to into the world with these sweet garlic and these badger flame beets and things like that, and just explain to people, like, this is what this is. It's a hybrid. They have breeders that, like, try to make the vegetables taste delicious so you don't have to add anything to it. You can just roast the beet, and the beet is what it is. People would say, like, literally, I would have to shoo people away because they're like, well, how do I do it? Like, how do I make that thing? What do I do with the squash? Like, I was like, well, what do you do with your other squash? And I mean, people are confused. Like, housewives and men and women, like, people just don't know what to do anymore because they are so used to processed food. Like,
right.
There's a grocery store that we all know that I probably won't name, but think about how they started out. Like, it was all like Whole Foods.
Which store could this be?
And it was all like organic, right?
But right.
Think about it today. Like, they would have signs that said, this is conventional and this is organic. And it was only supposed to be 10% of the produce that was conventional.
Right.
Everything else was organic. Well, today, if you go into the store that we won't name, like the Voldemort stores, everything is packed in plastic.
Right.
Like, half of the produce is just plastic from some factory.
And if you want an organic cheesy poof, there's a whole aisle for that. I mean, like, if you want, like, Cheetos or something, like, you can get an organic Dorito, an organic Cheeto, like, any of these.
But what does that mean?
Crappy, exactly.
What does it mean to have an organic Cheeto?
You can go and get, like, this ultra-processed junky junk.
Yep.
But tell yourself, well, it's a little bit better because I got it at this store that we shall not name. And it comes in a label that says, you know, non-GMO. Like, I feel good about that.
Right. So I think that that's where we are. And, you know, I don't want to skip too far ahead of you. But so, you know, that I was in Italy. I did the American Academy in Rome. They have a sustainable food program.
Let's talk about it.
And so I didn't want to come home. Because literally, Chef Sarah just goes in the back, gets the kale from the garden, the meat or the fish, it comes in, but it's not plentiful. So they're eating, like, for the time I was there, I think we had meat once or twice. So it's lunch and dinner for the fellows. And so the fellows, like, you know, are there just eating. And the idea of them being there is very holistic, Marion. It's like, what I would love to do is that you say to this creative person, be creative. We're going to feed you the foods that we think will help you to elevate whatever it is you're doing. And then you have community with people and you guys fellowship together and you eat this really great food. And then you go out into the world and you create something based on, like, your gut is healthy because you're eating all the vegetables. And it just was like the most enlightening thing. It's like, they didn't have a menu. They created everything every day. Like, you know, they was like, these are the greens we have. This is what's growing. These are the tomatoes. This is what this is. We're going to make this lasagna from fresh spinach. We're going to blanch it and cook it, roll it out. And every day it was just something really beautiful. We had lunch together, like these communal lunches. And it was a soup and everything just tastes like the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're there and you're like, wow, like, why can't this happen here? So there's a grocery store in Italy, Pam. Mm-hmm. Pam is the name of this like chain grocery store. So when you walk in the grocery store, the forward facing things are the peanuts. They're like the snacks, 99 cents or 99, like, you know, it's not a dollar, but a euro, right, whatever. And then you got like, you know how they have the big or the like 4 ounces or 6 ounces of mushrooms? Like if you could get, you get them here, they would be what? $8, mm-hmm. $5, $6. It was €1 for mushrooms. And then you get your eggs. And so everything was affordable. And so even when you do the conversion, like, it's easier for someone to live a healthier life. Not to say that they don't have poor people. They had lots of homeless people. I saw homeless people on the street. But I think I found there was access to healthier food. It wasn't expensive. It wasn't a luxury like it is here. Right. It's a luxury to eat well.
Right.
It's a luxury to have a nice, like, have beautiful greens or have, you know, something that's good for you that's going to really make you healthy.
Right.
It's not easy to access that here.
I wonder, and maybe you know about this, but when I think about having run a business, you know, I think about how we build waste into costs. Uh-huh. And we know that the U.S. food system, we're throwing away like 35-40% of our food. When you think about that level of waste, it's got to be built into the cost. So do you have a sense, like in Europe, are they wasting less food? Are they able to control food prices by controlling waste?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean,
obviously, the food system is inherently complex. But yeah. I do wonder how those margins are impacted by waste.
So I know that we have another podcast that the two of us like very much. And I think they talked about that on one of those podcasts about, like, in England, mm-hmm. how it is pretty similar to our model. Like, they're wasting and they are trying to figure out how to control the waste.
Right.
What I don't understand, because I started a compost program at Christ House, is like, where is this? What are you doing with this compost? Like, where's it going?
Where's it going? Yeah.
Are you making soil with this?
Right.
Like, I don't know. When I said to them, like, hey, what are you doing with this? They're like, oh, well, it was a very weird sort of non-nuanced answer. Like, I don't know myself.
Interesting.
So
we do our community compost. We have a compost in our town. It's like regional. They come pick it up once a week. It's very cool.
Okay.
And then once a year, they give us soil. Like, they make, it's not quite soil. It's like soil starter, whatever. Okay. It's compost that they've turned into something very rich in nutrients.
And what do you do with it?
I put it in my garden.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah.
In theory, actually, right now it's sitting on my front porch.
Okay.
But I will eventually, when it's planting season, put it in my garden.
Okay.
And it's exciting to see that loop, to really know where it's going. Because if you don't know where it's ending up, it's kind of like, yeah, like, what does it mean to be composting? But at the very least, you're keeping it out of landfills. And we know that so much greenhouse gas is emitted when food is fermenting in a landfill and has nowhere to go and to decompose. So
correct.
You're positively impacting climate change at the very least.
Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, I find it like hard to throw things in the trash.
Yeah.
So doing it for me gives me peace of mind. I just want to know that this is going to be soil.
Right.
And it's going to go to someone to either buy or give to a farmer or something like that. So that's very important to me.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it is. It probably
hopefully,
is.
Hopefully, yes.
So what inspired you to do this Italian sort of like food residency? Like, how did that come up?
So I have a friend who's a fellow, Glenn. He's my architect he's a landscape architect. And he was there and he said, hey, I have a friend who's coming to visit and she is a pastry chef. And they were like, oh, well, do you think she would want to come and like we can put her up and she can come and spend like 10 days or with us or whatever she wants, like a couple weeks, and just cook with us. And we had a Zoom call and I was like, well, what do you need? They said, we don't need anything. We just want you to come and show us, like, you know, it's a teaching kitchen. So like whatever you have to show, and then you can learn from us and just have a good time and relax. And that was Glenn's, they told Glenn the same thing. Like, he's like, what am I supposed to be doing while I'm here? And they were like, you're just relaxing. Go see Rome. Go just travel. And so we did. I made biscuits that turned out too salty for them because their salt is like it's so different.
Right.
But I made pâte à choux for them, and we cooked together and it was really great. I had a really great time. I thought that, you know, I didn't know that there was like, that I was doing something that everybody else was doing, right? So Chef Sarah does pretty much the same thing. I go into the kitchen in the morning. I figure out like, this is what I have. We're going to, you know, put some, I put olive oil on everything. I slather olive oil. And we just like herb it up, get fresh herbs, no dried herbs, if I can help it, and just marinate it, throw it, you know. From what I hear, though, with food is medicine, grilling, like searing is bad. Like, because it's like that Maillard reaction causes like some inflammation, whatever. We'll stay out of that. But searing it and then just giving, like you said, just clean.
Yeah.
The greens, the protein, and then the starch, whatever it is. And so they have a healthy meal. So that, for me, they were doing the same thing there. They were just cooking from the earth, very, very minimal. There was a lot of cream, though. There is a lot of cream and dairy, but it's different cream and dairy.
Right.
It's natural.
Right.
It's not the butter pastured. Tastes very cheesy.
Yeah, totally. Well, yeah, they do like cultured butter, pastured cows, and it's a great source of butyrate.
It is.
Which is great for the brain.
It's good for
and
the brain.
Gut lining. So, yeah, it is. It's part of the sort of complication, complexities of food as medicine, like eating higher quality, eating for your health, is that like butter isn't butter. You know, cheese isn't cheese, like broccoli isn't broccoli. And when you have these industrialized foods that are sprayed, like one of the things that really bugs me about the sort of nutrition food as medicine world is when we gaslight people who tell us that a diet helped them, because there's no reason for them to lie. Right. So when someone says like, I went on a carnivore diet and it healed my XYZ, like, I don't want to eat a carnivore diet, and I don't think they should probably eat it long term, but they're not lying. Like, they did feel better on that diet. So why? Well, what did they stop eating? They stopped going to Dunkin' Donuts in the morning, right? They cut out gluten. They cut out sugar. They cut out corn syrup. They cut out anything sprayed with glyphosate. They cut out industrialized grains. They cut out industrialized, like, so whether or not the meat they're buying is top quality, whether or not every single thing they're eating is hitting every nutritional marker, they're in ketosis now and their body is fueled differently and they're feeling good, right? Yeah. But we do this thing where we fight each other about what the quote unquote healthiest diet is when there are so many different ways to eat based on your condition. I recently saw on LinkedIn this battle royale in the comments section because somebody posted the new food pyramid and he was actually like being sort of generous about it. He's like, okay, this is not bad. Like, eat real food. Yes, like broccoli and meat at the top, fine. But it needs beans, like add beans. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of tongue in cheek. Like, he posted the same image, but just it was like somebody poured a can of beans over it. Like, there was beans all over it. Okay. It was funny, right? Like, it was cute and also like lighthearted and also like very moderate. Like, eat real food, add some beans. Don't forget your fiber.
Right.
The number of comments that were like, nobody needs beans. Like, carbohydrates are stupid and beans are poisonous. And it's like, okay, listen. Like, first of all, what has happened in your life that you're so mad about beans? Like, why are you in the LinkedIn of all places comments section raging
about
in
beans.
All caps about legumes? Like, this is wild.
Maybe they had gas.
Maybe. Exactly. Yeah. But that's the thing. It's okay. So you could conceptually argue them and say billions of people around the world live on pulses, like live on lentils and black beans and chickpeas. So wild to assert that they're poisonous. Or you could get the literature and say, look at all this literature that shows that like the fibers and beans help to lower cholesterol and
Right.
support a healthy gut and the microbiome. And or you could go, okay, this person clearly can't digest beans. Like, this person, when they eat beans, they get wild gas and they have a stabbing feeling in their gut and
Yes.
it makes them angry. I feel like we need to be willing to see the person in these debates. Because when someone comes and says, like, no, this objectively healthy food isn't healthy, they probably have just had a negative experience with it. Like, I don't really digest dairy. That's my personal story.
Yeah, we're the same.
I can see some objective health things. I was reading a paper this morning that was saying how there are, like, anti-diabetes qualities. The literature shows that some proteins in milk, like, you know, beta casein or something, has been shown to be anti-diabetic, which supports blood sugar regulation, whatever it is. Okay, that's interesting. I don't need to go in a comment section and be like, no, dairy makes my tummy hurt. Like, it's okay that I can't digest it. And it's okay that it's true that somebody else could and might even see a health benefit. It's okay that I don't cook with butter. And it's okay that somebody else might feel better
so
cooking
with
butter.
So what do you cook with if you don't cook with
butter? Like cooking, like sautéing or whatever, olive oil.
Okay.
I would drink olive oil. Like I enjoy the flavor of olive oil. It's delicious. It has beautiful color and flavor. And you can feel the antioxidants glowing.
Yeah. I put it on the fruit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah, olive oil on like peaches with a little bit of.
Just so this morning we have Tangelo's and kiwi. And olive oil, mint, and a little sea salt.
Yeah.
For the guys.
I love that. Yep. Yeah. And then if I'm baking, like avocado oil, just because it's more neutral.
Yeah.
You know? I'm a simple girl. Coconut oil.
Yeah.
I also have always in rotation, but I don't really cook with it unless I'm doing Indian food.
Goat butter?
Like in theory, I might, but I actually don't like the taste of butter. I think it tastes bad, which I think is so funny because butter is like that.
Do you bake with butter?
No.
Okay. So you're dairy free and gluten free?
Yeah.
Oh, well that's different. I don't know both. Like I know that
everyone says that, but I promise it's so easy.
Well, then you have a totally like you have something there. If you're doing both.
Both. Also egg free. I don't bake with eggs. I do eat eggs, but they're such a common allergen that I've learned to bake without them.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you need to come to the kitchen then.
Yes, we are. This is going
to
culminate.
I'm serious. You got to come to the kitchen.
And we have to do like a cooking episode where we're actually, to come to Cornell.
I'm coming to Cornell, but I need a business partner. It seems like, well, I don't know.
This is a brainstorming session. Just take some notes. If there are any investors in the audience, give us a call. We're two cuties who like to cook.
Oh my God. That's the name of the business.
Two cuties who love to cook.
There you go.
Two cooking cuties. Let them cook. Okay, we're going to have to workshop this.
We're
going to workshop
it.
Let's talk about it. Looking ahead, I'm going to rein us back in. I have this sort of slogan that I often say at the beginning of the podcast, and I was in my head about it today because I'm like, I always say, like, this is a podcast bringing personal narratives to public health topics. And like, is that too narrow? But kind of like the joke about it to me is like, everything is public health, right? Like, public health is not just like vaccines and like clean water. It's everything. And it certainly is like farms and cooking and food and like how we feed the most vulnerable in our society and like how we transform food waste into food success. Like, that's definitely public health, especially when you consider like whatever, the One Health framework and all of that. But similarly, I feel like food as medicine has been sort of categorized, boxed up. It has this little shiny box. And food as medicine right now is kind of defined as like when a person goes to their doctor and that doctor prescribes a dietary change. Like we're calling that food as medicine. But it's so much bigger. And I think that on a public health level, public health food as medicine is what you're doing, even as you, in your own words, kind of pull back from how aggressive you started. It's really what you're doing. So I want to talk about that sort of as we come towards the end of our conversation, what it means to implement food as medicine on a large scale. What are some of the biggest challenges? We have touched on many of them, you know, patient preference being huge. And we talked about this a little bit earlier before the mics were rolling. What is the role of the chef? Of the culinary expert in food as medicine, because mostly in food as medicine, policy conversations and such, we're hearing from the dietitians, bless their hearts, like thank you for their voices. We're hearing from the medical doctors, grateful for that. We're hearing from healthcare providers. We're hearing from insurance companies. We're hearing from researchers. We don't hear that much from chefs.
So I went to a forum hosted by James Beard, and there was a couple of restaurateurs that went on Capitol Hill to talk to and farmers together. Like it was the farmers and the restaurateurs. Like, listen, we need legislation that really, like, we can't separate the farmer from the chef. Like, we really need to talk about like how we can get sustainable food and the healthier food for people in restaurants, but also in just in communities. And I think that, I don't know if it was real well received. I think, you know, they listened, but I think it's hard, Marian. I think you have, it's so all over the place. Like, you, when you talk about food as medicine, it's like what you said. What is it? Like, you know, my idea is very grassroots. Like, you cook something and it's clean. You get it from a farm. You find the, you know, the cattle rancher, the dairy farmer, the produce, you know, the person who's making the produce. And you have an alliance with these people for communities. And you make sure there's a hub that people can, you know, get what they need. But then what do they eat? But then you can't make them eat it.
Right.
So the chef, you know, we talked about this a little bit, is like the restaurants that are out here like this on that mid-level, like the fast casuals, sometimes are doing the most harm. You know, there are places that are just like salad green places that we won't name, but then their proteins are from where? Like, where is this stuff from? And then where are you sourcing it? Because at some point, if you're so busy, it's just easier for the company to send you bags of things.
Right.
So what's in that bag? How, you know, so it, you really just have to, like, you joked and said you have to grow your own thing. You really do.
Yeah.
You really have to start growing your own food or figuring out, like, where the food comes from. Like, I can tell you if I'm going to the farmer's market on Saturday, on Sunday, that I get the eggs from this Meadowbrook Farms. I get this, you know, the my greens from this person or my apples. And I know. But is that important? I ask some of the guys sometimes, like, is it important? Do you care? And sometimes they don't. They just want a good meal.
Right.
For and whatever that means. Like, if it's healthy, it's great. You know, they think they're eating healthy because someone's taking care of them at the moment.
Right.
So
I think for me, like, the thing that I wish everyone understood, but of course it takes a fair amount of access and privilege to get to understand this, is that the cleaner, the fresher, the better grown, raised ingredients always taste better. Like, when you start with better ingredients, like, I'll make someone a meal, mm-hmm. and they'll be like, oh my God, what did you do? I'm like, nothing. I literally did almost nothing to these ingredients. I chopped them up, I rubbed them with olive oil and salt, and I ignored them in the oven for a bit. And that's what you're eating. Like, the ingredient is talking. It's just a really delicious carrot, right? It's a really delicious purple yam. I really did almost nothing, because when you have a good ingredient, you add some heat and some salt and some fat, and it blossoms, and so much flavor comes out of it. And you don't get that same, you know, you taste a grocery store carrot, you're not going to get that same flavor profile necessarily.
But I think people don't change unless they have to. And that's the thing. So people want convenience. Mm-hmm. So I tell, like, my staff, they hate. Like, we get this 40-pound box of chicken from a farm, and it has skin and bones on it. And, like, you got to break that chicken down, and you got to take those bones. We got to make the stock, because that's the buy-in.
Right.
Because they're going to charge you. So that 40-pound case of chicken costs $120. But the boneless case, the 40-pound case, costs $250.
Right.
Because they've already done the work for you. So they're right. going to charge you extra. So my idea is we would have to buy chicken bones separately that cost $59. So why not just take the bones we have and, like, clean this, and you can take the skins and make a chicharrone or whatever they say. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you have everything and no one's charging you extra. So you've just do the work. So right. I think we just the health scare or the reason that people are struggling with their health and that we're not healthy is because we want convenience.
Right.
People want that. People tell me all the time about that Costco chicken. I'm like, what is in it? Why is it $4? Right. Why is it $4?
It's a loss leader. Okay, folks. The Costco chicken is a loss leader. They're not making money on it. But
is it?
It is. Yes. It's a famously the Costco chicken. They make it really cheap because you get in the door.
Okay.
Costco hot dogs, you know, you pay $2 and then you spend $300 on, like, yet another pair of scissors.
Okay.
And Tupperware and, you know, the 10 pack of almond milk that'll be in your pantry for the next generation. They know what they're doing. And I actually really like Costco because you can get some really good stuff there affordably. I purchased a Costco chicken one time and one time only.
Uh-huh.
I was hosting a party for my daughter's birthday.
Okay.
And I was making tons of food and we were having tons of people. And I thought, I was nervous about protein. I was like, I should just have some egg, like some extra protein around. And my daughter also famously loves the rotisserie chicken.
It's does. Okay.
When she was a kid, she had tons of allergies. She couldn't eat anything. And so I would always travel around with a rotisserie chicken like in a cooler bag all the
time. Really?
Yes. It's okay. This could be a whole other conversation, but I was like always with a chicken.
Okay.
She and I would go on a date. We'd go to Whole Foods. We'd get a chicken. We'd sit there. We'd split a whole chicken. And that was our date.
Okay.
So I was like, you know, as a nod to her rotisserie chicken history, okay, I will get a couple because I was at Costco getting like hummus and baby carrots and whatever. I'm chicken privileged. I only eat organic chicken. Okay. And mostly from like a farmer that I know.
Okay.
It did not taste to me like what I think chicken tastes like. It did not taste correct.
And that's because
it was so big. I've never seen such a chubby chicken. Like she was big.
She was pumped with the hormones.
Titties, like there was
pumped with hormones.
Titties on that girl. She was out of control. Yeah. So my personal experience, I get why somebody would buy it. You could eat for a week on those breasts. But my experience of it as a chicken privileged person who has only had nutrient dense, like heritage chicken, which is much tinier and darker. I was like, what is this? And I no one ate them, by the way, because I had the spread of food. The chicken, nobody touched it. And I think I made broth from one of them. And then I was too scared to drink it because I wasn't actually sure like how many preservatives were in the broth. This is a confession that I think I threw away the one and only Costco chicken that I ever bought. But I've purchased it one time.
So yeah. I'm not a member of Costco, so I would not know about this chicken.
Yeah, they're big.
But
they're big. Yeah. And if you're on a budget and you can take a rotisserie chicken and make that into many things, so that like there it is. But it has like flavoring and it's
because it's probably eating corn and candy.
Yeah, candy
corn. Candy corn.
This chicken was fed Nerds gummy clusters.
Well, I saw that somewhere. I don't know if it was just propaganda, but really? I did see that sometimes they feed the chickens, you know, stuff like that.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah.
Okay, well, okay. So aside from not feeding Nerds gummy clusters to chickens, I want to bring this conversation home by asking what's next for you in terms of your curiosity, which clearly has not gone away from childhood, your insatiable desire to know how can I make this and how can I make it better. It started with a soft baked cookie and it continues with like a pan seared catfish, right? You're still that girl.
Exactly.
So where are you taking that curiosity in the next year, in the next 5 years, at Christ House, in your own explorations? What's on the agenda?
I think that I am ready to expand my baking empire and figure out how to make healthier baking with someone maybe or by myself. I'm not really sure. I do think so. I'm in the cohort for the food is medicine. So I still want to partner with a doctor and do some sort of, hey, this person has some hormone issues. What are the foods that they should be eating and do some curated meals centered around some health issues. So that is where I see myself going. I just have to figure out, like you, how to get there. But you got to kind of slow down and just kind of take it one day at a time, finish the course, figure out how I meet the right person. Because I think we talked about, like, early on, like, finding a doctor and this person, it didn't work out. So maybe like it's just timing and at the right time, really like getting together with people who really want to make the changes. And so I think that's what I'm hoping to do because I think it's only going to get worse if people don't eat better. And that's what I think I'll be doing.
Awesome. Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for joining me in this conversation.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm so grateful to have you as a friend and co-conspirator.
Yes.
And as a fellow food as medicine, curiosity-driven, baking, cooking girly.
So, I think you've surpassed me in the baking area of like I'm in awe of all the stuff you do. And so I need to see it.
Is join forces.
That's true.
That's the only way is to put with our powers combined, we are Captain Planet. Is that the right reference?
Maybe.
I think so.
I'm going to give you a book that I have that has, the book that is, Modernist Bread.
Oh.
I have Modernist Bread. And in Modernist Bread, they have a whole section of making your own gluten-free mixes. So I'm going to share there's the big books and then there's a spiral. So I'm going to share that with you so that you can see like what your gluten-free mix is. But I don't think anybody's doing gluten-free and dairy-free. So you got something going.
Awesome.
For sure.
All right. Well, and the next time that we get together, it'll be in a kitchen so we can show and tell.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Are you promising?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. We're going to make it happen. Okay. Thank you again so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope that I said something
inspiring. You did. Thank you once again for listening to the Marian Flaxman Network podcast, a podcast dedicated to reintroducing personal narratives into critical public health topics. For more information on me, Marian, please visit my website at marianflaxman.com. For more information on my guest, Chef Kendra Nicole Stevens, please find the links in the show notes. This episode was produced by Brain Trust Productions and sponsored by Inform Solutions Consulting. As a reminder, this podcast is separate from my work at Cornell University. Thank you once again for listening, and we will see you next time.